typical arrangement that we have here in the benighted United States. All right, what do I got today? I may turn around and get some stuff on from her tomorrow. I just sort of arranged to be doing some videoing at Wesley Foundation. I guess that'll be upstairs on the second floor. I haven't been there in a while. Used to be a great grand piano there, but that's been some years ago. Anyway, Folk and Roots is going on all around, and in downtown Urbana, Rose Bowl is hosting a bunch of shows. I saw the opening thing at Cranard, and it was marvelous. Hubby Jenkins doing some Black history. I elicited a response when he was talking about slavery days, and I talked about the cakewalk, and he went on and explained the cakewalk for quite a while. Performance as part of the slave's requirement. And he said something that I didn't know, which was that the dancing style they did was sort of mocking European dance styles, but it was sort of an inside joke. Plantation owners and viewers thought it was somehow complimentary, but the performers were trying not to crack up. Interesting story that. Well, we're going to kick it off with Radical Voice from Glenn Ford, as I usually do. Amy Goodman's got a commentary about Standing Rock again, about the Austinian Texas Tejas Oil Company, who likes Jackson Browne and maybe is having a break with him now, since Jackson Browne and a bunch of other people, Bonnie Raitt, are going to do a concert out at Standing Rock. Hopefully that'll be on video and will be a fundraiser. Speaking of fundraiser for Standing Rock, there's one coming up next week at the Independent Media Center. It's part two. Hopefully we'll raise money from quite a few different sources this time. People came out to Alto Vineyards. All right, well, I have a lot of material. Jeremy Scahill has got a short section. There's another piece of this, but he did a 25th anniversary for a radio show appearance in Connecticut. I don't know where he hangs his hat lately. He's got a new book out called Assassination Complex, following on Dirty Wars and Blackwater. I meant to grab Blackwater while I was listening to it, but I didn't get out the door with it. There's a section in there, I think, about Sudan and the early days of Blackwater was training Christian soldiers in the south of Sudan, and we see how that's working out now. What else do I have? Oh, Greg Palast has election protection, election theft report. Covers some of the same material, but I'm finding out that many people do not know about this still. Maybe it'll break through with this North Carolina voter suppression stuff that's going on. I'm pretty sure they're using the cross-check list to disqualify voters. Maybe they have other strategies as well. But people like two people down from interest groups in Chicago, Public Interest Research Group and Common Cause, neither of them knew about the impact that cross-check and that kind of voter suppression by spreadsheet engineered by Kurt Kobeck and the Kansas Bunny, funded by Koch. Speaking of Koch brothers, they're advertising on commercial television about what a great outfit they are. Methinks they protest too much. So, with all that as a preamble, and tomorrow I might have some India Benjamin. You can see her presenting today at the Wesley Foundation at 4 o'clock. It's a book signing for her latest book. The previous book was Drone Wars, and now it's In the Kingdom of the Unjust, which is a play on the expression that Saudi Arabia, the kingdom, gets its name from, if I'm understanding correctly. Maybe she'll explain that. Not that it's terribly important. But if I don't get to post-production her talk, I'll have some Gareth Porter, interviewed by Doug Henwood, and a very good interview. I've just been listening to it. And Reese Ehrlich, two of my favorite dissident voices on Syria and the Middle East more generally. Porter, U of I graduate, publishes most frequently now in Middle East Eye, a London-based journal, pretty new webzine. And but he's in Truth Out and all the usual suspects. And you can find him on Facebook. He's quite prolific. It's a good way to get to his... anyway, here's a broad brush critique of the American Empire from Glenn Ford, Black Agenda Reports.
By virtually every measurement, the United States is in deep crisis as both a society and as headquarters of global capitalism. We can roughly measure the severity of some aspects of the crisis with the tools of economic analysis. Such an analysis is quite useful in explaining why Washington is so eager to risk war with Russia and China, whether in Syria or the South China Sea or along the ever-expanding borders of NATO. To put it simply, the U.S. and Western Europe become smaller in terms of their economic influence with every passing day and cannot possibly maintain their political dominance in the world except by military force, coercion, and terror. Those are the only cards the imperialists have left to play. The ruling circles in the U.S. are aware that time is not on their side, and it makes them crazy. Or crazier than usual. The ruling class's own analysts tell them that the center of the world economy is moving inexorably to the east and the south, that this trend will continue for the foreseeable future, and that the U.S. is already number two by some economic measures and dropping. The lords of capital know there is no future for them in a world where the dollar is not supreme and where Wall Street's stocks, bonds, and derivatives are not backed up by the full weight of unchallenged empire. Put another way, U.S. imperialism is at an inflection point, with all the indicators pointing downward and no hope of reversing the trend by peaceful means. Now, that's actually not such a bad prognosis for the United States as a country. The U.S. is a big country with an abundance of human and natural resources and would do just fine in a world among equals. But the fate of the lords of capital is tied to the ongoing existence of empire. They create nothing but seek to monetize and turn a profit on everything. They cannot succeed in trade unless it's rigged and have placed bets in their casinos that are nominally 7 times more valuable than the total economic activity of planet Earth. In short, the lords of capital are creatures of U.S. imperial dominance. They go out of business when the empire does. The rulers are looking class death in the face, and it terrifies them. And when the lords of capital become frightened, they order their servants in politics and the war industries and the vast national security networks to take care of the problem by any means necessary. That means militarily encircling Russia and China, arming and mobilizing tens of thousands of jihadist terrorists in Syria in an attempt to repeat the regime change in Libya, waging a war of economic sanctions and low-level armed aggression against Iran, occupying most of the African continent through subversion of African militaries, escalating subversion in Latin America, and spying on everyone on Earth with a digital connection. All this to stop the clock that is ticking on U.S. and European world economic dominance. Left political analysts that I greatly respect argue that Hillary Clinton and the mob she'll come in with in January will pull back from apocalyptic confrontation with Russia in Syria, that they're not really that crazy. But I'm not at all convinced. The ruling class isn't just imagining that their days are numbered. It's really true, and rulers do get crazy when their class is standing at death's door. For Black Agenda Radio, I'm Glenn Ford. On the web, go to blackagendareport.com.
That's sobering. Glenn Ford, Bruce Dixon didn't put one up this week. Got one from Amir Abu-Jamal about Clintonism, where he quotes Chomsky. But I think I'm already running a little behind, so let's go to trying to pull up just a short outtake of Medea Benjamin, actually. I should have thought of it earlier, but I didn't expect to be here this morning, actually. So here is Amy Goodman's essay of the week, Breaking the Sound Barrier.
Music. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan in our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Barack Obama foreshadowed more complications for the Dakota Access Pipeline this week as he told an interviewer with Now This.
Right now, the Army Corps is examining whether there are ways to reroute this pipeline in a way.
Right.
So we're going to let it play out for several more weeks.
With hundreds arrested in recent weeks at the standoff at Standing Rock, North Dakota, the movement to halt construction of this 1,200-mile, $3.8 billion oil pipeline only builds. Musicians are increasingly joining the fray, striking an unexpected chord, pressuring oil billionaire Kelsey Warren, CEO of Energy Transfer Partners, which owns the pipeline. Warren also owns a small music label and recording company and is the founder and driving force behind the Cherokee Creek Music Festival in Texas. Many musicians, including folk rock legend Jackson Browne, are banding together to confront Warren and help stop the pipeline. In a statement published in September by Indian Country Today Media Network, Jackson Browne wrote, "I met Kelsey Warren on one occasion when I played at the Cherokee Creek Music Festival held at his ranch. Later, his company, Music Road Records, produced an album of my songs, though I was honored by the tribute and think highly of the versions, which were done by some of my favorite singers and songwriters. I had nothing to do with producing the recordings or deciding who would be on it," Jackson said. He continued, "I do not support the Dakota Access Pipeline. I will be donating all of the money I've received from this album to date and any money received in the future to the tribes who are opposing the pipeline." The album Brown referenced is titled Looking Into You, a tribute to Jackson Browne. Emily Saliers and Amy Ray, better known as the folk duo The Indigo Girls, have been to the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation and the resistance camps, where thousands have been met by an increasingly violent, militarized police force that's facing down the Native American water protectors with attack dogs, armored personnel carriers, pepper spray, concussion grenades, and deafening acoustic cannons. In addition to raising awareness and funds for the land and water protectors at Standing Rock, the Indigo Girls are organizing musicians to challenge Kelsey Warren directly. They wrote in a recent Facebook post, "Kelsey Warren also happens to be a passionate music lover and owns a festival. Indigo Girls have played the festival and had a song on the Jackson Browne tribute record. When we participated in those events, we had no idea about Kelsey Warren's connection to Big Oil and its imminent threat to the Standing Rock Sioux. Now we know," they wrote. They wrote a letter then to Kelsey Warren, which was co-signed by Jackson Browne, Sean Colvin, Joan Osborne, Keb Moe, and others. Indigo Girls' Emily Saliers reads a part of the letter.
"We realize that the bucolic setting of your festival and the image it projects is in direct conflict with the proposed Dakota Access Pipeline, a project your company, Energy Transfer Partners, is responsible for spearheading. This pipeline violates the Standing Rock Sioux Nation's treaty rights, endangers the vital Missouri River, and continues the trajectory of genocide against Native peoples."
The letter concluded, "We will no longer play your festival or participate in Music Road Records recordings. We implore you to stop construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline," Indigo Girls wrote. Kelsey Warren is a Texas oil billionaire several times over and might not be easily deterred by a threatened boycott. In fact, when global oil prices began dropping, Bloomberg Markets reported, quote, "Nobody was happier about the crash than Energy Transfer Chairman and CEO Kelsey Warren," unquote. "All is competition," Warren gloated, vaporized. He, like many analysts, anticipates that oil prices will rise, fracking in the Bakken shale region will boom again, and his Dakota Access Pipeline will be the only conduit to carry the crude oil to the Texas Gulf Coast for refining and export. Warren told Bloomberg, "You must grow until you die," unquote. Well, Jackson Brown also wrote in his own statement, "I intend to support public resistance to the Dakota Access Pipeline as much as I can. To quote a song of mine, which side? The corporations attacking the natural world, drilling and fracking, who do it with the backing of the craven and corrupt? Or the ones who fight for the earth with all their might and in the name of all that's right, confront and disrupt?"
There's a restlessness out in the street, there's a question in the air. How long, if this theft goes on, will our country still be here? People know the game is rigged, even as they play. They see their expectations slowly slip away. They got subsidies for billionaires, that's a bailout for the banks. A monopoly on medicine and a sale on armored tanks. The whole damn country's being sold out that revolving door. Between Washington and Wall Street, like it's one big dollar store.
In the press release about the Jackson Brown tribute album from Music Road Records, Kelsey Warren wrote, "I don't know of anybody that admires Jackson more than me," unquote. Well, Jackson Brown and other musicians like Bonnie Raitt have just announced they're going to perform on the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation at the Prairie Nights Casino on November 27th. That's the Sunday of Thanksgiving weekend. As Brown and other musicians rally with the land and water protectors at Standing Rock, and as President Obama signals post-election action on the pipeline, it's time for Kelsey Warren to face the music. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Well, what a brilliant thing that was, huh? Not his favorite song, apparently, that one. Well, I'm going to edit my program on the fly here. I've got just a short section from Women's International News Gathering Service. It's actually originally from a program called A Woman's Point of View from WMNF. Women's International News Gathering Service has been around for a long time. And it had been aired on Sunday afternoons in the Women's Collective spot, but I don't know if it's regularly happening. I guess Sunday afternoon I'm just doing other stuff. I haven't checked in on that. But this is where the host introduces Medea Benjamin, and I'm only going to play a short section of it because I do want to get on with those other features that I actually said I was going to play, and I think I can still do it. All right, let's hear about Medea Benjamin in town this afternoon at 4 o'clock at the Wesley Foundation, sponsored by the PDA and other groups. Aware, Progressive Democrats of America. If PDA doesn't ring a bell,
she's intelligent, but compassionate. She has a rare blend, and I can't think of anybody I'd rather be talking to with the challenges we have. We'll be looking at Saudi Arabia, but we'll also be looking at the Middle East in terms of Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton and some of the things we need to do. So, Medea, let us hear you speak now.
Okay, I think we're working now.
I am so glad you're focusing on Saudi Arabia. For those who might not be familiar with Medea Benjamin, she is the co-founder of Code Pink, but before that, she founded Global Exchange, and she's written actually 8 books, and the book that we're most going to be focused on right now today is Kingdom of the Unjust, Behind the United States-Saudi Connection. And Medea, with Code Pink, just real quickly, I'm going to go back. We were also worried about the invasion of Iraq. And, you know, we had our warnings, our color signals, et cetera, orange and red and green and blue and pink. And not pink, but you decided to do pink. Isn't that how actually you organized Code Pink?
That's right, Mary. That was coming out of that crazy Bush color-coded alert system that made no sense except to keep people in the state of fear and to justify an invasion. And so ever since then, we said, all right, let's choose a different color, and that calls for a different kind of reaction. Go after the people who attacked us, and let's remember that 15 of the 19 of them were Saudis, and not invade a country, Iraq, that had nothing to do with 9/11.
Yeah, and you know, Medea, I have followed you now for years, whether it's in the North Korean demilitarized zone, You've been fighting for the Palestinians for years, and for women in all kinds of areas, whether it was Syria or Afghanistan, etc. And right before the Republican convention, you were out in the streets, and I was watching it on TV, and I was afraid you might get run over by a horse. And you were concerned because finally, after 14 years, they released those blacked-out 9/11 studies about Saudi Arabia's involvement. What did you think about that?
It was crazy. That's right. They had 14 years to do it, and they chose the time, a Friday afternoon, right before Congress was getting ready to go on its summer recess, and right before the two national conventions were beginning, timed perfectly, brilliantly, to be totally disregarded by the mainstream media. And that's exactly what happened. So imagine these families, the 9/11 families who had fought for so long to get this information out, only to find that it was done in a way that nobody paid any attention to it.
Let's go back a little bit with Saudi Arabia, because, you know, it seems to me, and they act like they've been there forever, you know, kind of the whole pillars of the Middle East, if you will. But actually, they've only been around since 1932, about. And so tell me, what was about, well, obviously oil, but from the get-go, whether it was the Carter administration or the Reagan administration, we seem to have a really special relationship with Saudi Arabia.
That's right. It started out with oil, and that went on for decades, with the agreement that the U.S. would provide the security for this kingdom, which needed security because who wants to be ruled by a monarchy that just passes down the mantle from one brother to another. And the U.S. would prop up this regime in exchange for getting oil. And in the process, the money, the vast, vast billions of dollars from that oil was then, much of it, invested in the United States, in treasuries, in U.S. companies, and then started the weapons sales. That really began in the 1980s, 90s, and Saudi Arabia has since become the number one purchaser of U.S. weapons. According to the administration itself, $110 billion just during the Obama years. This is huge business. And so between oil and petrodollars and weapon sales, we have become tangled up in an alliance with one of the most repressive regimes in the world.
Yeah, and under the Reagan administration, they extended our, quote, special alliance with Saudi Arabia. And so tell us a little bit about, first of all, why do they need to be so repressive? And let's go into a little bit about the repression in Saudi Arabia.
Well, that's a good question about why do they need to be so repressive. I would say, first of all, because they're a regime that is totally antithetical to democracy. They don't allow people to speak out at all. They don't allow any kind of dissent. In fact, peaceful protesters get beheaded. People who merely blog that they want to look at alternative forms of government get put into prison for long prison sentences in addition to lashings. There is no room for political parties, for independent trade unions, for even non-profit human rights associations. There's no respect for religion other than the extremist form of Wahhabism. There's no respect for women's rights. There's no respect for the millions of migrant workers who have flooded into the country to take the jobs in construction and domestic workers that where they suffer tremendous abuses. So it is a society on all levels that is built up for male Saudis to benefit from the vast amounts of oil that they just happen to have under their soil and with no accountability to the population.
Medea Benjamin, they're interviewed on a program called Wings, and that is available pretty easily on the web. So look for Wings, or Women's International News Gathering Service. And she's going to be probably already in town. Maybe she's traveling from Chicago right now. Maybe she's tuned in. Welcome. Let's hear Election Theft Report. Speaking of Chicago, that's where Dennis Bernstein, and the host of Flashpoints, caught up with Greg. Some screenings all around town.
Paco now.
That's right. I just was with Reverend Jackson and Operation Rainbow Push, where they are, where there was a showing of the film for ministers and activists, and they're going to be sending it out for viewing up to 1,000 churches for Souls to the Polls Day on Sunday. The best democracy money can buy.
But of course,
go on. Yeah.
But of course, the battle to protect the vote continues apace. And there's a number of things to talk about, and there's all kinds of stuff going on. But let's get right to this notion of vote caging, which is incredibly troubling. And once it's another racist scheme to prevent people from voting, particularly people of color.
Yes. Okay. Here's the latest game that's going on. There are Republicans or Trump supporters who are sending letters into African American communities. You know, it's easy to get a voter list, registered Democrats and African American communities. And it says, "Do not forward." If the letter comes back undelivered, they use that as evidence that a voter doesn't, that it's a ghost voter, it's a fake voter. Now, of course, if you are voting illegally, you're going to go to jail, and you should go to jail. I mean, we don't support illegal voting. But there's a lot of reasons why people do not respond to their mail. Now, here's the other thing, is that under federal law, you are not supposed to remove anyone's registration within 90 days of an election unless there is serious evidence of fraud. But the state of North Carolina, many of the local board of many of the local elections clerks are taking these cockamamie return letters from Trumpsters and removing people from the voter rolls, including there was one 100-year-old African-American woman who, for some reason didn't get her letter. And by the way, if you misaddress the letter, and you could do that deliberately, it'll come back too. And a lot, there's minor errors in, there's about 1 in 6 registrations has a minor error in it. And that causes a letter to be returned too. Now, they haven't found any fraudulent voters, but they have, they're knocking off droves of African American voters in North Carolina.
No, wait. This 100-year-old. This was an important part of her life. Voting was one of the things that that essentially she lived for.
Yeah, she thought she was going to be voting one more time, at least in a historic election in North Carolina. But you know, it's voting for anyone, whether you're 100 years old or 19 years old, and I can tell you my daughter's been refused registration in Georgia. Let me talk about this sending letters out to people.
Please.
Number one, it's an old trick used by the Republican Party, and those who've seen my film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, know there's a segment I have with Bobby Kennedy, because we did this investigation together for Rolling Stone the first time. We uncovered in 2004 that the Republican Party was doing this. Now, here's the thing. The Republican Party is under a consent decree. They did this back in the 70s, 60s and 70s, and so they're under a consent decree, the Republican National Committee, not to play this game anymore, sending letters to people and then challenging them. So one of the tricks that's used in North Carolina now, supposedly it's not coordinated by the Republican Party. Rather, it's supposedly individual Trumpsters who are doing these mass mailings. However, conveniently, Republican voting officials are then taking their ridiculous evidence of a returned letter and knocking people off the voter rolls. Now, the problem is that if you're knocked off the voter roll, when you walk in, they'll give you a provisional ballot. That way you can think you voted. I call provisional ballots placebo ballots because they make you feel like you voted, but you haven't. If you're not on the voter rolls, even if you were wrongly removed, even if you're wrongly removed, that's too bad. Your provisional ballot doesn't count. Demand a real ballot. If you, you know, and raise hell. One host of KPFK shows, Kerry Harrison, in June, when he was told he had to vote on a provisional ballot, actually went out in the street in L.A., found a cop on the beat, and demanded and brought in the cop and said, "I want that poll worker arrested. She's blocking me from casting my vote, which is against the law." And the cop said, "Give him a real ballot." Really, I'm not making
the that. Oh, come on.
Yeah.
The cop came?
That was a rare, that was probably a one in a million shot.
Now, was this a Keystone cop? This is Hollywood.
So,
are you sure he was real?
But this
he
really
just
happened,
didn't walk
but
off a set?
That was one of those things where you just don't expect that to happen. But for the most part, I would not expect a cop to tell you. What you have to do is you have to demand an adjudication by a pollster. But let me go back to this system.
Okay.
It's called caging. When you send a letter to people and it comes back, the letters go into a literally, it's a term in direct mail used for return letters that come back. The letters are generally opened in cages, especially if they have money in them. So it's called caging. And back in 2004, and then again in 2008, we found that Karl Rove's office at the Republican National Committee under a guy named Tim Griffin, who then became a congressman and is now a lieutenant governor of Arkansas, that he sent out these lists that they were sending out mass mailing. And here's where they were sending these letters to. Are you ready for this? They were sending letters to African-American students at traditionally black colleges during summer vacation, during the summer break in August, so that they knew that the students weren't there. That they didn't know that they all knew that they weren't illegal voters. They just knew that the students weren't there because it says do not forward. Those students lost their right to vote. Then there was another group, which is the homeless. They were sending letters to people registered out of homeless shelters. Even if you lose your home, you're not supposed to lose your vote. So they're mailing letters to homeless shelters, hoping people won't get their letters, and then they challenge them as not existing. By the way, the GOP, when I showed them the list at first, they said, "Why are you sending these letters out? What is this caging list here?" And I showed them a bunch of names, thousands and thousands of names. And they said, "Oh, that's our donor list." And I said, "Oh, well, there's several hundred people here at homeless shelters. What do you do?"
They said that was their, so they outright lied.
Really? The GOP outright lied?
Greg?
I know you're shocked, but they... Yeah.
My jaw is, I can't get it up.
You know, it's like, no, they really said that the homeless, that, you know, and then I said, you know, these are homeless shelters. And then they decide they better change their answer, that they were, and they were saying, no, these are letters just welcoming voters. So you get a lot of voters out of homeless shelters.
Well, were you wearing your Channel 4?
I wasn't even faking it. I was there for BBC, but they didn't realize that we actually had these lists. They didn't know what they were. And then the spokeswoman ran back and spoke to the chairman of the Florida party where we happened to be in Florida, and said, "Oh, well, no, these aren't our donors. No kidding." And then, are you ready for this last group of people that were massive? Number of people they mailed to minority soldiers and airmen,
really
at the, like, for example, at the Jacksonville Naval Air Station, who were sent overseas, so that, in other words, go to Iraq, lose your vote, mission accomplished. In other words, they were sending letters.
No, wait, go to Iraq, lose your vote, your mind, and maybe a limb.
Yeah. And mission accomplished.
Mission accomplished.
As far as the GOP is concerned. So they literally were sending letters to soldiers at their home addresses where they can legally vote, or at the base where they were registered, the Naval Air Station where they were registered. And they said, do not forward. And, of course, if the guys are assigned overseas, and we actually checked with the families. These were guys sent overseas. So the letter went back to the Republican Party. The Republican Party was challenging these voters. Now, I brought in Bobby Kennedy, joined me in this investigation. And by the way, this is all in the film, The Best Democracy Money Can Buy, which is now available on download from Amazon. It's in the film. And Kennedy takes a look at these lists and he says, look, this is, This is a felony crime, sending out letters like this, when it is a direct violation, first of all, of for the GOP, it violates their consent decree with a federal court. The second thing is it violates the Voting Rights Act of 1965. Now, the Voting Rights Act, the heart of it, of the civil side of the act, was cut by the Supreme Court into little pieces. But they left the criminal side, and clearly this remains a criminal act. You can't target black folk with some type of trick to get rid of their votes, or Hispanics. You can't, or, you know, any group. And it is a felony crime. And instead of the state of North Carolina busting the criminals, which is what they ought to be doing, they're taking their information and using it to wipe voters off the voter rolls of North Carolina. I mean, it is, and that they're pulling this trick. Bobby Kennedy, as he explains in the film, you know, this is a go-to prison felony. And we have a state government which has decided to go to war against its voters and in North Carolina. Now, North Carolina is important for two things. North Carolina and Ohio and Arizona, you put those three states together, I'd add in Nevada. You take the four states of North Carolina, North Carolina, Arizona, Ohio, and Nevada, and you have the four states which could not only decide the presidency, but those are the four states that will decide whether we have a Democrat or Republican Senate. And you can have a Democratic president or Jill Stein as president, and if you have an all-Republican Senate, we're going to have a very nasty business with the United States Supreme Court. You're going to have a dead government and a Supreme Court that's going to turn right. These guys are actually counting on Ruth Ginsburg to die. Isn't that nice? So that they can go back to having a conservative court, no matter who's president. Now, I'm not telling you whether to vote Republican or Democrat, but if they win the Senate by this type of trickery, and it's not just happening in North Carolina, the caging that we've discovered is happening in North Carolina because they happened to hit a couple people. You have a very active NAACP. I was there. I was talking with Reverend Barber just the day before yesterday, Reverend William Barber, who is chairman of North Carolina NAA. And so he's militant, and he's got his eyes open. But this is happening. You think it's just happening in North Carolina? It's just that in states like Arizona, we just don't have the eagle eyes open for protection. Plus, the Justice Department has decided to actually radically reduce the number of observers in these states. They said, in light of the Supreme Court decision, since we feel hamstrung, we're not going to be there. Which is, frankly, I don't understand that at all. So this caging business, and it is inconceivable that this was just done by one or two lone people, because it's all over the state. Someone is coordinating it. They're not going to reveal themselves for the obvious reason that if it's a GOP official, if it's the Republican National Committee, then they go to jail right away because it's contempt to violate it.
Well, shouldn't there be some kind of, forgive me, I don't want to be too stupid and naive,
no,
but shouldn't there be some kind of criminal investigation? Isn't there a pattern here,
yes,
that demonstrates that somebody should take a look?
Absolutely. One of the problems is we have a slow-moving and somewhat a frightened Department of Justice right now. Now, there was a second thing going on, which we've discussed before on our Elections Crimes Bulletin. If you've been listening to Greg Palast and Dennis Bernstein rag on about this, is a system called CrossCheck.
Yeah, we did that one 23 weeks ago.
Yes, and now it's in full freaking swing. And what's happened is that you had Donald Trump running out and saying that people are voting many, many times, and that's how the election's rigged. Yes, Donald, the election's rigged because you're accusing people of voting many times, which no one would care about if he's just blown through his comb over. The problem is that he has actually gotten 30 Republican secretaries of state to turn over their voter rolls to his henchman, the Secretary of State of Kansas, Chris Kobach, who, and I think we'll have some review of our discussion of him. And one of the things that they're doing is they are hunting down and targeting these so-called double voters. Their hit list includes 7.2 million people. And this is, again, this is all in the film, but it's...
And the film, again, let me say, again, Greg, the film is The Best Democracy Money Can Buy. I've seen it once all the way through and then a couple of different times, a part here and a part there. The film is extraordinary in its direction in terms of how to really look at what's going on and to understand that it's a national program. There are variations on the theme. Sometimes states have picked it up exactly. They've added their own variations. They've put their own little spins on it. But this is a, when Trump is talking about a stolen election, he's right. It's being stolen, but not from him.
Well, exactly. And what's happened is that they're targeting voters. For example, Virginia actually admitted that they've removed 41,000 people based on Trump's accusation of people voting twice. 41,000 people. Now, here's the interesting thing. They haven't arrested anyone. Now, you vote twice, it's a go-to-jail crime, 5 years in the slammer under federal law and more under state law. They haven't arrested anyone. So if someone's voting twice, that's like closing your bank account if you rob a bank. I mean, if someone's committed the crime, they should arrest them, but they're not arresting them. They're just taking away their vote. Why? Because they know it's a phony charge, but that the Democratic Party will not defend people because, oh, we're not going to defend double voters. The Democratic Party has been completely dead on this one. I want to thank the ACLU for, in California, for example, stopping it there. But until my investigation for Rolling Stone, no one had the lists of these double voters. I actually got their lists. They try to keep them from me. They call them confidential, but that's what Greg Ballas does, is get the confidential stuff. And it's things like, you know, they have James Brown, and they have James Brown Jr. and James Brown Sr. are considered the same voter who's voted twice. And not just some James Brown Seniors and Juniors. They have 288 James Brown Seniors and Juniors mixed up as double voters in the state of Georgia. And now they haven't arrested James Brown, junior or senior, but they're removing their votes. I mean, I'm laughing, but it's really, this is what I call the new Klux Klan. This is lynching by laptop, except instead of white sheets, they're using spreadsheets. And I want to tell you, this could very well determine the United States Senate and maybe the presidency if there's that surge that Trump is counting on. Again, it's not about whether I agree or Dennis thinks that Trump should or shouldn't be president or the Republicans should win or lose. This is about going back to a new Jim Crow tactic, and there is no defense. And now I have to say that the Congressional Black Caucus has demanded not only an investigation of this system called CrossCheck, but after seeing my film, Alcee Hastings, the congressman from Florida, said, "I was a federal judge. I know a criminal conspiracy when I see it. This is it." And he walked my evidence over to the Justice Department and put it in the hands of the Attorney General.
But, Greg, the election is 6 days away.
I know. Well,
where are we now? I mean, this is good that he did.
I'm getting apoplectic, too. That's Dennis Bernstein. Sometimes Wednesday feature, most likely on Wednesday. They've done it for quite a while. I want to get on the other segment that I was talking about, also from... Well, no, this is from the East Coast. This is from station celebrating the show Between the Lines. And... it's with Jeremy Scahill, who has three books out. Maybe he's working on another. I haven't seen him publishing a lot on The Intercept lately. Again, Medea Benjamin in town at 4 o'clock. After I thought I was going to be out of town, I've managed to get some UPTV equipment, and we'll probably be recording that. So here's Greg Pallas, we just heard, and now Jeremy Scahill.
But, you know, the thing that I thought was not to go after how right-wing Hillary Clinton is much faster. Remember, Hillary Clinton wouldn't say Bernie Sanders' name for months. She was really hoping he was going to go away or was going to sort of be like Dennis Kucinich, or he was just happy to be there in the debates. And then at the end of it, he gets like a daytime slot at the DNC that, you know, that no one watches. Well, Sanders actually raised a tremendous amount of money, enough to run a full national states-based campaign. And on some key issues, I think he really drew blood in the debate against Hillary Clinton, particularly on her connections to Wall Street, her relationship with big industry and wealthy donors, the corruption of the campaign finance system in this country. There's no question that Sanders did that. But is it because Sanders it was some magical being? Was Hillary actually afraid of Bernie Sanders the person? No. What they were afraid of is if a national or international audience is allowed to hear the views that so many people in this country hold as important or true about what needs to change in the society, then things actually may change in this society. In a way, what I thought was the most important revelation from the Sanders campaign was that someone who articulates basic ideas, progressive ideas, actually has a pretty wide range of support in this country. I liken it to what happened with Obamacare. I personally think, for me, Obamacare is a terrible thing. I mean, my premium has gone up. It's awful. I didn't get to keep my doctors. I just got another email the other day saying that my premium is going to like almost double. However, for a lot of people in this country, Obamacare is a major improvement on what they had. For people who need to stay on their parents' health insurance, for people that had no health insurance, there was a real pre-existing conditions. There was a real benefit provided to some of the more vulnerable people in our societies through Obamacare. Now, why am I bringing that up in the context of talking about Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton? It's because when Republicans and Democrats and independents and others alike are asked about certain core components of Obamacare, they say they support it. But when they're asked if they support Obamacare, they say no. And that's there's a partisan mentality on that. The same is sort of true in our electoral politics. When Bernie Sanders articulates ideas about the economy, about our campaign finance system, an enormous number of Americans agree with those things. And so it's not about Bernie Sanders. I mean, Bernie Sanders is actually kind of a curmudgeonly guy. I was actually shocked at how much charm he mustered up, because he's not charming, actually. And he's an old white guy. It sort of flashes of Nader in some ways, where it's like you wish that someone else was in that position who wasn't an old white man. But the point of this is, what was Hillary Clinton afraid of at the beginning of Sanders' campaign? She was afraid that she was going to be hit from a large, quieted group of people in this country who actually support progressive change, who don't want corporations running our electoral process in a macabre form of legalized bribery. And he posed a real threat. And I think that strategically, he made a big mistake by underestimating the Clinton machine, and he thought that he could sort of play clean with them. And only late in the game did he start to focus on a foreign policy level on the fact that Hillary Clinton was a key player in the regime change in Libya. When she was cavorting around with Henry Kissinger, some of the comments that she made about Bernie Sanders that were blatant red-baiting attempts by trying to make it sound like he was a complete apologist for Daniel Ortega, and then twisted who Daniel Ortega, the head of the Sandinistas, who he actually was. What's kind of hilarious about that is that the Clintons were friendly with Daniel Ortega and his wife at the time, and Hillary Clinton went to gatherings with Daniel Ortega. Bernie Sanders went and heard him speak once. But the hypocrisy of Clinton's foreign policy and the hawkish sameness of the elite Republicans and the elite Democrats that leads to people like George H.W. Bush endorsing Hillary Clinton, Sanders almost didn't touch it at all. And the fact is that if you watched Tim Kaine debate Mike Pence the other night, Tim Kaine invoked Reagan and the 80s more often than Mike Pence. You know, it was like St. Reagan has appeared and somehow anointed the Democrats now as his rightful successors. And to, I think, a great extent, on many policies, that's true. Hillary Clinton, on a foreign policy, represents sort of right-center Republican thinking from the late 80s, early 90s, including when the right up until when President Clinton was elected. They are kind of stuck in time. And if you look at who's endorsed Hillary Clinton, one person that should just be, you know, on everyone's radar and that should, it should be viewed as scandalous is John Negroponte, who was, of course, the U.S. ambassador to Honduras and the key official in Central America organizing the financing of the Contra death squads in Nicaragua. When the diplomatic cables from Negroponte's time in office as the ambassador to Honduras were obtained by the National Security Archive, they showed that not only was Negroponte meeting regularly with his good friend General Alvarez, who ran Battalion 316, the Honduran Army U.S.-backed intelligence unit that disappeared scores and scores of people, but that Negroponte was reporting that the human rights situation in Honduras was like Switzerland. One diplomat said that Negroponte makes it look like we're talking about Switzerland here, when in reality you had death squads in Honduras being supported by the United States through Negroponte in Honduras. You had Negroponte using Honduras as a staging ground to funnel all forms of support to the Contra death squads in Nicaragua. Negroponte then goes on to be George W. Bush's director of national intelligence, deeply implicated in the legitimizing of torture during that administration. And Hillary Clinton has put this guy's name on her website as someone she's proud to have the endorsement of. While her running mate, Tim Kaine, was just attacked last week because this right-wing Catholic lobbying group, Catholic Vote, said that he had spent time with a Marxist priest in Honduras. It actually kind of made me like Tim Kaine that this story came out. That Marxist priest that they were talking about, that Hillary Clinton's campaign never responded to, never denounced this attack on Tim Kaine. Tim Kaine, when he was a law student, went and volunteered in a Jesuit community in Honduras for 9 months. And during that time, when he was with the Jesuits, and remember what was going on, Catholic church women, including nuns, were being raped and murdered by U.S.-backed death squads in El Salvador and elsewhere. You had Jesuit priests being executed by graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. You had Archbishop Oscar Romero shot dead while he was saying mass at a church, again, by two graduates of the U.S. Army School of the Americas. At that time, when Negroponte was the ambassador, Tim Kaine was there as a young Jesuit volunteer, and he went over to Nicaragua to seek out an American Jesuit priest named Father James Carney. Father James Carney, I had read when I was living at the Catholic Worker in the 90s, I read his memoirs, his autobiographies of becoming a revolutionary priest. And ultimately, James Carney renounced his U.S. citizenship, and he left the Order of the Jesuits because he felt that his the best use of his life in the world was to join with the campesinos and the revolutionaries who were fighting against U.S.-backed death squads and despot regimes in Central America at the time. And he went, Tim Kaine went for one meeting with Father James Carney, and that now has turned into a scandal where this lobbying group is saying, what did James Carney teach Tim Kaine? You know, it'd be like, what did Jeremy Scahill teach you that one time you went to see him speak somewhere? And then 35 years later, that somehow is like the skeleton in your closet after, you know, being pro-death penalty, against abortion, all of these things as a public official. Somehow there's a scandalous leftist inside of Tim Kaine. But that was a scandal. What was not a scandal is that while Negroponte, Hillary's endorser, was the ambassador of Honduras, Father James Carney was abducted by Negroponte's friends and killed by being thrown from a helicopter. Negroponte then covered up the involvement of U.S. advisors and the CIA in the assassination, or rather execution, of Father James Carney. Instead of saying, you know, any of this about her running mate and the attacks that he endured leading up to the vice presidential debate, she touts the endorsement of a man who covered up the murder of a U.S. citizen by a Honduran death squad by throwing him out of a helicopter. Hillary Clinton has more in common with the Contra death squads, when you look at her endorsements, than some former Contras have. I mean, she has the all-star team of people that were responsible for the vicious, dirty wars throughout Central and Latin America. She also has the neocons endorsing her. The Weekly Standard now loves Hillary Clinton, the official organ of the neoconservative movement. Max Boot, who has never met a war he didn't want someone else's kids to fight, is a prominent endorser of Hillary Clinton. There's a whole slew of some of the most reprehensible former U.S. officials and political figures that constitute a big core of Hillary Clinton's foreign policy endorsements. Who Donald Trump can point to are really the craziest of the crazy in the military. People like Jerry Boykin, General Jerry Boykin, who you know, said, our God is greater than Allah, and that's why we win. And, you know, really radical sort of crusader type guy. His top, Trump's top military advisor, General, you know, Mike Flynn, suggested that the U.S., if they feel it's effective, may consider killing the family members of suspected terrorists as a way of leveraging intelligence from them. Wants torture brought back, etc. But Hillary has the all-star teams. George H.W. Bush, former CIA director, a man deeply involved with the dirty wars in Central and Latin America, not only his time as CIA but as Reagan's vice president. Then you have, the Kagan brothers, who are, the intellectual architects of the project for a new American century. And, it seems like the only, true scumbag that hasn't endorsed her yet is Donald Rumsfeld. And after this last tape, I wouldn't be surprised if Rumsfeld now endorses Hillary Clinton. And now why is, you want that to happen? I don't know. I mean, maybe there's some radical libertarian here who wants Gary Johnson to, after he figures out where Aleppo is, to really tell us how he's going to change the country. But so I'm saying all this not as a sort of guilt by association thing, because these people, these right wing, just vicious individuals, they're not endorsing Hillary Clinton because they're holding their nose to do it. Their core interest is the empire. Their core interest is corporate profits for the war industry. Domination. Some of them really do view themselves as in a war to destroy Islam in the world, but they're not endorsing Clinton because it's like lesser of two evils. Hillary is who they want. Hillary is their candidate. They have everything in common with her on a foreign policy level, infinitely more than they do with Mike Pence or Donald Trump. It's not that Pence or Trump wouldn't be manipulated by them or they couldn't still push through with their agendas. But the Clintons are part of the politics of empire in this country. The Clintons and the Bushes, closest thing we have to monarchy, business in this country. Hillary Clinton has supported all of these core war policies when it mattered. Later, she'll say, I made a mistake. Her explanation for voting for the Iraq War was totally ridiculous, saying she thought that they were voting for sending inspectors in. First of all, that's just complete malpractice if you're a lawmaker and you thought that that's what that bill said. But also, if you listen to her speech on the floor supporting the invasion of Iraq, it was clear that she wanted regime change. Now, is it just about her time in the Senate? No. When her husband was president in 1998, and Bernie Sanders also endorsed this, they signed into law the Iraq Liberation Act, which made regime change in Iraq the law of the United States, which meant that it was the precursor for what Bush and Cheney ultimately did, because they had a bipartisan consensus that at some point we're going to overthrow this government. And Clinton signed this bill that was actually written by individuals who worked for the Project for a New American Century, the Rumsfelds of the world, wrote this. Clinton signs it into law. Sanders, by the way, did support that bill. And then you have the Republicans take power. 9/11 gives them the rationale in their minds that they need to go and invade Iraq. And the rest is history. But Hillary Clinton was totally supportive of that war even before it happened. And then later, when it became politically untenable because she was running against Barack Obama, who had carefully come out very narrowly in a qualified way, against the Iraq war because it was a stupid war. But if you listen to that speech from Obama when he really was starting to think about becoming president, October 2002, it is not an anti-war speech. It is a highly qualified opposition to a single U.S. war. And it was really brilliant politically, but it put Hillary into a very tough position because the perception was Obama's the anti-war candidate. He wasn't the anti-war candidate. He was the anti-Iraq war candidate compared to Hillary Clinton, who had voted for this thing.
Jeremy Scahill, most recently the author of The Assassination Complex, a book, part of that Dirty Wars, and which was a book and a documentary, and I guess it screened at the Art Theater Co-op some time ago. Maybe it was before that happened. Anyway, and his first book was Blackwater, about the mercenary trainers and mercenaries. It's time to go. Medea Benjamin will be in town to afternoon to talk about her